Les colloques du Collège de France.
So hi everybody. So welcome to the round table. So before the round table, we are honored to have Ignazio Visco. Ignazio Visco spent most of his professional time at the Bank of Italy. After a PhD at the University of Pennsylvania, he moved to the Bank of Italy, and he was a governor of the Bank of Italy from 2011 until 2 years ago. And he was after Mario Draghi became the governor of the Bank of Italy. And so we are happy to have him here. So the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, by the way, for 5 years I lived here as the chief economist of the OECD. So in the late 1990s. So that was some experience. Now, artificial intelligence has a long history. As technological change on the interpretation of economists, there is a range of opinions. I will be very brief. I'll give some historical quotes, discuss how we move from the ICT to the AI revolution, talk about financial systems, about macroeconomic policies, because the idea is to talk about policy challenges, and much has to be said on inequality, the impact on demand and competition. I think a few words on international cooperation are necessary. The story starts many years ago. We can do without Ricardo or Karl Marx, but we can certainly start with Keynes. Keynes, almost a century ago, was saying things like, assuming no important wars, no important increase in population, the economic problem may be solved within 100 years. A student of his, James Mead, posed a different question to the one that Keynes had initially posed. He interpreted Keynes as saying that the need to work only an hour or two a day to obtain the total output of real goods and services, the need to satisfy needed to satisfy our wants. It was the main question that Keynes posed to himself. According to me, instead, the main question was, what should we do when output per man hour of work is extremely high, but basically output goes only to a few property owners, while the mass of workers are relatively or even absolutely worse off than before. In 1984, one of the greatest experts in artificial intelligence of the time, Niels Nilsson, wrote a short essay on employment, growth, and income, and artificial intelligence. He noted that artificial intelligence and other developments in computer science are giving birth to a dramatically different class of machines. Machines that can perform tasks requiring reasoning, judgments, and perception that previously could be done only by humans. It is already 40 years ago. So we are discussing things that were very much discussed in the 40s. And he confronted the views of two Nobel laureates, Herb Simon and Vasily Leontief. And basically, Simon was saying that at some wage, labor would be employed in equilibrium no matter how efficient machines become. He used the law of comparative advantage. We would use other techniques today to say that there is not an obvious prediction what that wage will be. It does not guarantee that real wages will not drop as the economy's productivity improves through mechanization. It does not even guarantee that real wages will remain above the subsistence level. However, nothing about what's happening today, given what we know from history, says that things will be different. At the end, there will be more labor and higher wages, because it would be higher productivity, and higher productivity linked to real wages being up, if the cost of capital remains constant. And there is no basic impact of machines on that. Leontief was saying instead that over the next 30, 40 years, many people will be unemployed, displaced, creating massive problem of dislocation. And in the last century, there was an analogous problem with horses. This is a famous comparison. Horses disappeared, and from agriculture and also from the everyday life, they were substituted by tractors, machines, trains, and so on, and disappeared. There are very few horses today compared to what. And he says the risk is for human human beings really to disappear unless I echo something that has been said, the government can redistribute the fruits of the new technology. And at the end, we have a conclusion by Nielsen out of that. First of all, Nielsen would object to Simon. Nielsen, not an economist, saying, well, it's unclear whether his prediction that there will be improvements in employment and in wages would survive an analysis in which technology makes possible a shift from salaries paid to humans towards salaries, he was saying, paid to machines in the form of higher profits to robot owners. Would he include, he asked Simon, these salaries or as wages or as interest? But he also concluded saying that it would be foolish and tragic for us to slow our progress towards automation because of concern about unemployment. The world needs all the productive capacity it can create if its inhabitants are ever to live as human beings should. And he concluded. And he concluded with these sentences: as automation takes over more and more of the work heretofore performable only by humans, we need to take steps to ensure that people become unemployed in a gradual and non-disruptive fashion. New approaches to work, such as job sharing, should be encouraged. Shrinking of the work week and the compensating increase in income derived from non-employment sources, such as stock ownership and transfer payments, should be produced in step. It's an interesting thing, because these are words that we find somehow in the mouth of a number of those who participate to the debate in the economics profession today. But thanks to the deployment of all the data that we have been able to collect that come from the early days of the new economy, of the ICT revolution and so on, now really things are a little bit changed. We have moved from deductive to inductive artificial intelligence. What does it mean is that we are able to put together all the information that's accumulated and try to do to use it to complement what humans do, or perhaps even to substitute what humans do. And actually, the evaluation of how much this will help what humans do is subject to uncertainty. We heard from Philip this morning that there is a wide range of uncertainty on the estimates. Actually, perhaps there is less uncertainty, because some of these estimates are either extremely too low or extremely too high on this exponentiality that somehow you can read in some Goldman Sachs or other papers. But there will be some, and since there will be some, but living still in a world of uncertainty, the question is what policymakers should do. And it is interesting, because we know that there are pushes for productivity up, but also we know that there will be effect on productivity that will dampen it. You can read in Jones, all the discussion about the Baumol effect. When I was a kid, I remember very well this Baumol effect, the quartet, and the fact that it dampens productivity simply because people move. There is a lot of... The big problem is not that there is a lot of gains in overall productivity, but at the same time there is a dampening effect, is that gains, how is it distributed? So that is the main question I think policymakers have to see. And we can think that policymakers not only have to discuss how to make the best out of the AI developments, but also to mitigate the risks that are inevitably associated with that. And the basic thing is that at the very end, the discussion that has been taking place is very linked to what Atkinson was saying 10 years ago. Tony was saying that the direction of technological change should be an explicit concern for policymakers. Then he added, encouraging innovation in a form that increases the employability of workers and emphasizes the human dimension of service provisions. This is a judgment value statement, which I agree with, but we have to compare it with the efficiency that may be generated even if people are not going to be employed. The big problem again is, can we devise ways that as there is a reduction in employment or a displacement of workers or the labor share of income goes down, whether there is a possibility of compensating that through the distribution or redistribution of the fruits of AI technology. We know something about what's happening in financial systems. In financial systems, there are a lot of efficiency gains, which really can come from trading, lending, credit scoring, fraud detection, a better organization of activities. We also know that there are risks which are very relevant. And the big thing is that these risks have to be somehow, in my opinion, attached in a preemptive way. There have been a lot of discussion at the policy level about the impact of artificial intelligence and what policymakers should do. Two reports last year, end of last year, are very interesting. One is an OECD report, the other is a G7 Commission report. They both end up saying that policies have to be somehow, policymakers have to be prepared and flexible. Now, I think that preparedness is very important, and flexibility also, if you react to something. And obviously, if there is a stabilization policy that's put in place, it has to react to something that changes. And therefore, you have to be prepared to react as the change takes place. You have to study, to try to see scenarios and so on, and intervene in a way that somehow is compatible with your objective. But there are areas like the one that Philippe Aguillon spoke before, competitive system concentration and so on, or financial market system and so on, in which really it would be extremely wrong to wait and see. It is something which has to be attacked from the very beginning. You cannot maintain a system that reduces competition, increases concentration, and wait to react when it is late or perhaps too late. And the same on the financial side. There are a number of things that are taking place now. There are papers which are interesting in the Bank of Italy, where I come from. Very recently, a few young people have devised ways to better use artificial intelligence to deal with a number of issues, are raised in the banking community, on how to adhere on regulation, on how to best know whether certain credit is going to be producing bad loans or not, and these are excellent studies, papers and so on available. But there is a set of principles that are being thought. So far, somehow the guidance from the authorities is considered by us as sufficient to avoid major risks. But major risk had to do with the application of machine learning, the application of something that is not as deep as the generative AI that we are living in now today. There are a number of studies, some of which echo some of what has been discussed this morning. One just came out from my experts is very interesting. They tried to replicate scandal that happened in the United States a few years ago when an asset manager tried to use assets he was managing to cover losses that he had accumulated in some other place. And he was a great mathematician, smart and so on, but somehow he didn't behave ethically enough, or he basically went against the rule. So they tried to compare various foundation models, Gemini, all the chat GPT, the Claude, and so on, to try to see how they would have reacted when instructed to maximize the profits of the asset manager given certain assets when there was something that happened that was reducing profitability, given the rules of the game that were very clear. that you could not use the funds of your customer to cover your losses. And at the same time, however, they were instructed to maximize their profits. And at the same time, that was interesting to know that audits take place once a year. Well, the interesting result is that these were behaving in an unethical way. Basically, they maximize profits at the expense of consumer protection. And this is the working of the foundation models. It has been trained in a way, that model, that produces a result which is not the one that as policymaker we would like, but as the general public community would like. And so what to do? Well, we have to have explainability. This is very difficult and very costly, by explainability of all the black boxes that are these models. You have to ensure that human beings at the end are in charge rather than just deliver the results to the modeling. You have to understand whether a number of biases, we call the hallucinations and other things, can be generated by this kind. A friend of mine, who is a Nobel Prize physicist in Rome, got a paper to referee on subjects that he had done. And he told me, well, at the end, I saw this interesting bibliography. There was also a reference of a paper of mine, which I never wrote. And these things happen. And these, more frequently than we think. So there is a lot of work and restraint that the regulatory regime can do in that field. On the macro side, it's a little bit different, because obviously there is high uncertainty on the final effect. And so the question is whether you should react or be preemptive. It's very difficult to be preemptive. And I think actually the interesting thing is that let me see if I have a quote. Well, is this quote. The interesting is that at the end, what we have to be concerned if the real economy is going to distribute the benefits that we are uncertain how large they are, but they will be in a way that is satisfactory to our interests. The tools, obviously, are adjusting. We have now casting. We have improving some forecasting with applications from AI and so on. We can monitor supply shocks better. For example, the bottlenecks that we didn't see when we were doing monetary policy in 2021 perhaps could have come out using better data and so on. But really, it is not transformative. Instead, in the two areas that Tony mentioned and that Philippe Aguillon mentioned, that is inequality and competition and concentration, I think a lot can be done. On the inequality side, we know that there has been a sequence extraordinary: PCs, internet, the smartphones, the tablets, digitalization, robotics, and so on. As a consequence, unlike at the time of the ICT, when we wrote interesting books at the OECD, there was one on the sources of growth that were somehow saying that policymakers had to pay special attention to education and to technological change, trying to foster it, and competition, trying to have more competitive markets and so on. Contrary to that, the difference is that now artificial intelligence is still a general purpose technology, but is a little bit biased. It is not as wide-ranging ICT that could complement all our activities. These substitute as much. In the substitution, there are certain risks. And the risk is, my impression from reading the literature and so on is at the end, in a way or another, the labor share will go down. And basically, there will be more competition for low-paid jobs. And the prediction that Simon had, that wages would rise with productivity, might not take place. I think that there is a large probability that this could really happen if things remain unchecked. And at the same time, there is one issue, that there are those who are somehow in better position will get richer and richer. But if they get richer and richer, most of the benefits, the fruits of the productivity changes will go to them. There will be a few, and all the other will be many without the fruits, or perhaps with stagnating or reducing wages, real wages. It is not going to be mass unemployment, but the risk is poverty. But basically, there is also a fall in effective demand. If there is a fall in effective demand, how to compensate for that would be very difficult. There are a number of proposals on social security, basic income, and so on. All of them are a little bit tough. One is, for example, move taxation from capital to labor with care, because you don't want to tax innovation. But there is also a more drastic solution. At the end, if everything will be in the hands of few, and nobody will have the income to purchase what has been produced by those few, what will happen? Either it will be reduced, or the property rights will have to be distributed, so that you will complement the low incomes of the many with the incomes from property rights, the property of the Magnificent Seven. Talking about the Magnificent Seven, we have an interesting table which I put together, which has to do with concentration. We know that concentration. I'm not going to repeat what has been said by Philippe, but look about the returns. These are total returns except dividends. With dividends, it's the same thing. In 10 years, the Magnificent Seven, the one you know, that are written down there, had an annual return of almost 40% a year. The rest of the US big cap had 8%. The rest of the world, 1%. I mean, this is the way we are distributing somehow the ownership of exactly those basic assets that are all concentrated now in these seven and few others. I'll conclude with a word on international cooperation. I think one of the things that you read in all these reports is that, well, since there are global problems, and global problems are these obviously the effects of this technological revolution, which are still to be understood. Once you add to that the production of ideas, like what Aguillon says, or the risk of singularities that Turing envisaged many, many years ago. But you're living with this kind of challenge, which is global, in a confrontation between now, which is almost a war, China and the United States, or United States and China, with Europe, which is lagging behind. There was a conclusion about the Draghi, that you have to follow that recommendations by Aguillon, which I share very much, but I would not give up the social system that we have engineered in Europe. I wouldn't like to have medical care cost us as in the United States. But what is very important is that unfortunately, now international cooperation is fading. The world is becoming fragmented, extremely fragmented, and there are risks that common goods, fighting climate change, trying to reduce poverty, which has been a major success of the globalization between countries, not within countries, or a number of things that have been envisaged we can only be fought by acting together. The risk is that at the very end nobody will take place, and we will go back to a world like the one the oldest of us were used to live before the Cold War ended. But that would be very dangerous in fields in which instead we could devise a cooperative approach, because it would be clear that it would be in everybody's interest. Think of finance. In the case of finance, we have international transaction. What happens in a country has effects on others. We need to have regulation which somehow converges. There are various views. On finance, people think that the market-oriented, state-oriented, or rights-oriented different regulations between the US, the China, and Europe at the end can converge to basic principles. In other areas, it's more difficult. So I would start with those areas in which we can converge and slowly try to somehow, it will take many, many more years, to put together again the difficulties we are facing now. Can economists remain silent? And that, I think, is a challenge for the economists who have been policymakers, but also for the economists who are in the academics. And what's happening in the US now is very, very worrisome, because there is fear to speak. And I think we have to be capable, really, of trying to emphasize the good things and showing that the bad things have to be fought together rather than isolated. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.